In Ukraine, a city is bombed. Civilians run for cover and hope for help.
I hope on our army. Our army, it's very, very good and very strong. And I hope on America, USA.
Also this hour in Taiwan, people are closely watching events in Ukraine.
Taiwan is different from Ukraine. And we are much more important for the United States than Ukraine.
Or is that wishful thinking? I'm Marco Werman. Plus, in Warsaw, Frédéric Chopin is a local hero, but good luck finding his music.
Everyone told me the same story. Chopin is available in Warsaw on Sundays during the summertime at 2 p.m.
How a Wisconsin pianist helped change that, all that and more, today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is day 6 of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Moscow has been targeting civilian centers with increasingly powerful weapons. A 40-mile-long convoy of Russian tanks is making its way toward the capital, Kyiv. We'll be hearing from Kyiv later in the show. The UN says at least 136 civilians have been killed since fighting began, and more than 600,000 people have fled Ukraine. In Geneva, about 100 diplomats walked out of a speech given by Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. There is a lot to unpack today. We begin our coverage focused on Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv. Rocket strikes from the Russian military have hit the central square, a city government building, the city's opera house, and the ballet theater. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the situation earlier today. Zelensky said that there were dozens of victims. This is the price of freedom, he said. This is what mourning is like for people in Ukraine. Yulia Potetskaya and her family live in Kharkiv. I spoke with her this morning. Yulia, first of all, are you safe? Because many people in your city are spending their nights in bomb shelters and basements. Is that what you've been doing?
Now I'm at my home and I'm safe. Thanks God. My children with me, my husband with me. We have a lot of people who are in bomb shelters now. For example, near me, we have school, and there are 500 people now.
Have you and your family gone there?
No, me no. I have three children, and it's very difficult to be there.
What has the last day or so been like for you and your family?
It's terrible days for us. It's catastrophe, because all the time, bomb and rockets, a lot of people die, and it's catastrophe.
Do you have enough food? Is that a concern for people in Kharkiv?
Yes, me yes. I bought a lot of food before it started. Now it's a problem because shops, it closed. But even now, you can buy something. You can buy food. But it's very dangerous to go to this market. A lot of people, elderly people, they can't go to anywhere and they don't have food at home. And it's very dangerous to go to somewhere, of course. I know a lot of elderly people who now don't have food. Even in metro or school, people who there, it's problem with food.
In metro, so like in the subway, underground train?
Yeah, underground, yes.
Yulia, do you feel safe?
No, I don't feel safe. I don't feel safe. I don't know how will this night.
Will you be able to leave?
I will try tomorrow. I will try tomorrow to go to Dnieper. I have car, but it's dangerous. We don't know from where a rocket will come. It's very difficult and dangerous, but I will try to go to Dnieper because I'm director of Hillel, Jewish organization. And in Dnieper, I have Hillel too and a lot of friends. And I can go to them and to be there. It's not a problem. I can be in any Ukrainian cities. But the problem that all the time bombs in Kharkiv, all the time, not stop it. To be honestly, I don't want to leave Kharkiv. I don't want. But today, when bomb was a lot and my children cried, and I understood that I have to I have to go because of children.
So, yeah, I mean, that's so difficult, isn't it, Yulia? At a time like this, what do you tell your children? How do you explain to them what's going on?
They know that it's Russia. They know. We have war of 8 years, and they know everything. But it's terrible. It's very difficult.
Yulia, where are you finding hope right now? Inspiration, where do you find optimism?
I hope on our army. Our army, it's very, very good and very strong. And I hope on America, USA. I hope on Europe. I hope on God.
Yulia Potezkaya lives in Kharkiv with her family, enduring an assault by the Russian military. Yulia, thank you. Please stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you.
There's also an economic war being fought. Today, France's finance minister said the West will force an economic collapse in Russia. That prompted Russia's former president, Dmitry Medvedev, to post on Twitter, "Don't forget that in the history of mankind, economic wars have often turned into real wars." The sanctions that Western countries have enacted in recent days have had a rapid impact on the Russian economy. Yesterday, the value of the ruble crashed against the dollar. Many analysts say the country could indeed face an economic collapse caused by Western pressure. Richard Nephew is with Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. I asked him to compare how these new sanctions compare to previous moves.
The sanctions that had been in place against Russia at this point were very targeted. They were focused on a few Russian oligarchs, as well as a few companies. And the effects of those sanctions were intended to be long-term things, as opposed to something that would have immediate economic effect, all of which were imposed in 2014 and 2015.
So now there are all these sanctions from every direction on Russia. Russia has been disconnected from the SWIFT banking system, for example. Can you get specific for us on SWIFT? By removing Russia from this global banking system, give us a chain of events that would, again, make Putin reassess his entire military campaign.
Yeah, so first it's important to step back and think about what SWIFT is. It's instructions to move money from one bank account to another. And so if you think about it, there are lots of other different ways in which you could convey those instructions. And so this is where I think the SWIFT sanctions themselves are a bit overrated. They're important. They make it more difficult for Russia to engage in transactions, but they don't necessarily make it impossible.
Give us the same explanation for the sanctions on the Russian central bank.
So effectively, what we have done is said that the Russians are not allowed to utilize the U.S. dollar-denominated, euro-denominated, and other partner currency-denominated reserves that they have. If you think about what reserves really are, reserves are essentially large amounts of currency in other countries that you potentially will have to be able to finance trade. By blocking off the ability to utilize the dollar, it's going to make it much more difficult for the Russians to tap into those reserves to be able to finance trade, which is part of the reason why the ruble has collapsed in terms of value. It's just seen now as a more problematic place to do business in Russia because you can't do business using some of those intermediary currencies that otherwise would be used.
So, Richard, how do you think ordinary Russians are going to feel the effects of all this?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is just a fact of how sanctions work, that ultimately, even if you try and prioritize and target them on those you're especially attempting to influence, the business people and the industries, if you target the oil and gas sector, you're targeting individual oil and gas workers at one level. You're affecting their jobs. And the same thing, can be said with regard to banks. The same thing can be said with regard to, any kind of entity that is ever subject to sanctions. So in a direct way, there are people who are going to lose their jobs over this.
What about Russia's 1%? And doesn't that include Putin and the oligarchs?
It does. And so then it's a question of whether or not those people are going to feel the pain of the population feeling the pain. I think that, the oligarchs are going to be particularly affected if they're added themselves on designation lists. We saw the European Union yesterday put out a very large list of Russian oligarchs. If those people had a lot of assets in Europe, they're frozen now. So they might feel the pain pretty directly, right? If their bank accounts are being frozen, if they're not able to engage in their normal activities.
Is it possible for Russia's economy to be completely walled off?
North Korea is our poster child for an economy that's completely walled off. Is it possible? Yes, but it comes with massive costs, dislocations, and problems.
Richard Nephew, a senior research scholar at Columbia University Center on Global Energy Policy, speaking with us about sanctions and how they can work on Putin and the Kremlin. He joined us from Washington. Thank you very much for your insights.
Oh, thank you very much.
During World War II, the British military commander Bernard Montgomery said, "If we lose the war in the air, we lose the war and lose it quickly." So far in Ukraine, it seems that neither side has gained or lost control of the skies. But to try and tilt the playing field, the EU just announced that it will deliver 70 new warplanes to Ukraine. Joining me now to discuss this is Matthew Powell. He's a teaching fellow at the University of Portsmouth in the UK, where he focuses on the history of air power. How important is air power in the war in Ukraine, Matthew? More or less important than we think?
I think it's hugely important. And what we're starting to see here is the contesting of the skies above Ukraine and the difficulties that that can create for ground forces to operate with the freedom that they might want to.
If we go back to the start of the Russian invasion, Ukraine had an early detection radar system. Russia forces knocked that out. They bombed airfields and runways. What happened after that?
Ground-based air defense systems that the Ukrainians have got that are in place, man pads, are starting to still have an effect. They haven't knocked those out completely. And so you're not just focusing on the war in the air and the fight that's happening between aircraft, but also you have to now knock out the rather sophisticated ground-based air defense systems that exist.
And so what is your assessment of the Ukrainian ground-based air defenses?
They've certainly caused a lot more problems than I think the Russian forces were anticipating or would have planned for in all of this.
Ukrainian pilots, they've quickly achieved a kind of legendary hero status. Why is that?
I think partly it's to do with the mythology of warfare. People like to have something to hold on to. And if you can create those myths, it allows you to perform better, something that's boosting your morale against your opponent.
There is this mystery of where the Russian Air Force has been, Matthew. According to one estimate, about 300 Russian warplanes have been sitting on the tarmac within easy flying distance of Ukraine. You have any ideas why they never showed up?
I think, again, it comes back to that idea of contested airspace. And these are valuable assets that if the airspace is contested, you don't want to risk them. I think that's going to become a problem for air forces in the future.
Well, the EU security chief, Joseph Borrell, said this weekend that the EU would pay for more warplanes to be sent to the Ukrainian Air Force. In the end, he emphasized they were coming from EU members, 70 warplanes on their way, we're told. Do you see this as tipping the balance? How will this help Ukraine gain an advantage in the sky?
The one thing it will really allow them to do is to prevent the Russian Air Force from dominating the skies. And if you cannot dominate the skies, it makes your ground offensive much more difficult.
Well, yesterday and today, I mean, there's been a lot of talk of the Russian military convoy stretching about 40 miles outside Kyiv. I mean, it seems like a ripe bombing target for the Ukrainian Air Force. Do you see that happening? And why has it not happened?
It could suggest that the Ukrainian Air Force is losing that battle for dominance in the skies and that the Russian generals and commanders are becoming more confident in having these convoys in vulnerable positions, and they are in hugely vulnerable positions to attack from the air. So it could suggest that. It could also suggest, however, that the Ukrainians feel that they're better served attacking these columns on the ground and trying to isolate them through perhaps guerrilla tactics. And so it could be an adaptation from the Ukrainian side to husband the resources that they've got for the air to try and keep contesting the skies when they really need to, and relying on ground forces to try and interdict these supply chains and these columns that are advancing.
Matthew Powell is a historian at the University of Portsmouth in the UK, focusing on the history of military air power. Matthew, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. President Biden gives his first State of the Union address tonight. Biden will likely highlight U.S. support for Ukraine as an independent democracy under attack. People in Taiwan are watching all of this closely. They want to know what America would do if their democratic island comes under attack by China. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
The similarities are hard to miss. An elected government told by its much bigger neighbor, "You are illegitimate puppets of America." That could describe Ukraine or Taiwan. Taiwanese political scholar Tang Xiaocheng calls it a parallel situation.
The parallel situation is firstly the history, the historical background, and secondly, the role of the United States.
the role of the United States. Both Ukraine and Taiwan are heavily armed with U.S. weapons. Ukraine is now using that military hardware to fend off Russian invaders. But if anyone thought the U.S. was considering going into Ukraine, President Joe Biden says, no, Ukraine is on its own when it comes to actually fighting Russian forces.
We're dealing with one of the largest armies in the world. This is a very different situation, and things could go crazy quickly.
That was Biden talking to NBC recently. And when the president said that, Taiwan's government perked up. Tang says it made people there wonder if the U.S. would have Taiwan's back in the case of a Chinese invasion.
Before that, the government very confident that in the worst case scenario, the Americans will intervene, will help us, will come to our aid. But the case of Ukraine proves the other way.
He says that is not something many Taiwanese politicians want to say out loud, even if they're thinking it. Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, did come out and say, first, that Taiwan condemns Russia, but then to her own people, don't panic over the invasion of Ukraine.
President Tsai Ing-wen has stressed that Taiwan is different from Ukraine, and we are much more important for the United States than Ukraine.
Professor Tang says this is an article of faith among Taiwan's top leaders. And yet no one really knows how the U.S. military would respond to a Chinese assault on the island. That's intentional. The U.S. has a Taiwan policy called strategic ambiguity to keep Beijing guessing. But it keeps Taiwan guessing, too.
The Americans never make clear whether they will do it or not. This is only a belief from our side that the Americans will come to our aid.
Polls show very few Americans want to see U.S. troops in Ukraine. With Taiwan, about half of Americans say the U.S. should defend the island if China invades, but half also say America shouldn't even sell weapons to Taiwan. So the public is ambiguous, too. After Russia's attack on Ukraine, Taiwan bumped up its military alert level in case China gets any wild ideas. Beijing responded by saying, and this is a quote, Taiwan authorities act just like a drama queen. Here's Hua Chunying, spokesman for China's foreign ministry. It's unwise for Taiwan authorities and others to take advantage of the Ukraine issue as a hot topic, she says. Taiwan is indeed not Ukraine. Well, Professor Tang also hopes that is true.
Taiwan still has a chance to make peace with mainland China.
When it comes to Russia, the White House mostly wages economic warfare, sanctions. That might not work with China. It has a much bigger economy that is deeply entangled with the U.S. economy. And with both cases, there is the looming threat of missteps leading to nuclear war. That seems to be at the top of Joe Biden's mind. He told NBC he won't even risk going into Ukraine to rescue U.S. citizens, let alone the Ukrainian government.
That's a world war. When Americans and Russians start shooting at one another, we're in a very different world than we've ever been in.
Ditto for Chinese troops. And Beijing knows it. Chinese state media recently said to the U.S., we know you'd never come to rescue Taiwan because if you had such, quote, evil thoughts, you would quickly remember our nuclear arsenal and think twice. For the World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Today, in famous birthdays, Frédéric Chopin. The Polish composer known for his nocturnes and mazurkas was born 212 years ago today. Chopin was a defiant nationalist. He deplored the fact that Russia was occupying his native Poland, as it did in the early 19th century. And at the age of 20, Chopin left Warsaw, never to see his homeland again. Today, Chopin is a pride and joy of Warsaw. Still, until fairly recently, you'd have struggled to hear a live performance of Chopin's music in his hometown. Reporter Rebecca Rossman has a story of an American who helped to change that.
In 2006, Pamela Howland, a pianist from Wisconsin, came to Warsaw with her husband on what quickly became a failed mission. They couldn't find a single live Chopin concert. The owner of their bed and breakfast, a guy named Jarek Szoladecki, made some calls for them.
Everyone told me the same story. Chopin is available in Warsaw on Sundays during the summertime at 2 p.m. in a park.
This is Howland's husband, Wendell Myers. He says they were shocked. Only on Sundays in a park? Szoladecki says at the time, Poland was still rediscovering its identity after decades of being under Russian communist rule.
And Chopin was like a backbone maybe of Polish culture, but not very important for me, to be honest with you.
Howland wasn't ready to accept that.
So Pam said, all I need is a piano and a venue, and I will come back at my own expense, and I'll play Chopin.
In 2009, Szoladecki invited Howland back not only to perform, but to lead a workshop for young artists from all over Eastern Europe. Then in 2010, on Chopin's 200th birthday, Szoladecki and Howland launched what became a yearly Chopin festival.
Thank you, bardzo. I'm very happy to be here.
They wanted to make Chopin's music more accessible, bringing it back to his preferred kind of venue, the salon. Even if it was previously frowned upon, says Helena Goldberg, a professor of musicology at Indiana University.
In the Polish musical national discourse, he needed to be rescued from the salon. He was not a salon composer, he was a great composer kind of a statement.
But Szoladecki and Howland couldn't have disagreed more. For them, salons were more personable than big concert halls.
The life of the musician, totally detached from the audience, just concentrated on the notes and the instrument, is, I think, depressing.
He shows me the room attached to his B&B, which he converted into a 19th century Viennese-style salon, complete with a grand piano and old-fashioned wicker chairs. For nearly 10 years now, this salon has hosted nightly Chopin performances. By a new generation of maestros, particularly those overlooked by the big stage. Howland passed away from pancreatic cancer last September, but not before reaping the fruits of her labor. Take this scene from 2013. Howland is playing Chopin on a grand piano being pulled on a trailer across Warsaw when suddenly a vehicle pulls up beside her. It's Paul McCartney giving her a thumbs up.
And I wish Paul knew, you know, a few years earlier, he would not have seen Chopin on the street at all. And that it's Pam that was really instrumental in making that happen.
For the world, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Warsaw.
We'll be right back with more in the next half hour of the show. You're with the world. Marco Werman here. It takes a village to keep the world spinning. Listeners from around the globe helped us exceed our goal of $67,000. The following supporters span time zones and borders to help keep the world free and accessible for everyone. Adam Kapp, Susan Kingston, Andre Kuzmiers, Mary Langlois, Andrea LeBlanc, Unsuk Lee, Helen Liebner, Mary Lentzner, Marion Lloyd. Thank you for helping us bring global reporting to millions of people around the world. Nations and corporations take action to isolate Russia. They're joined by a host of sports federations.
September's Russian Grand Prix has been cancelled.
Russia and Belarus being suspended by World Rugby until further notice.
International Ice Hockey Council also suspends Russia and Belarus national teams.
The sports world pushes back against Putin. That story's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Just a few months ago, armed rebels were advancing on the capital of Ethiopia. We're advancing, and then things changed pretty quickly. Ethiopian government forces pushed back fighters from the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. Still, the conflict in northern Ethiopia, in Tigray, that began more than a year ago, it is not over. Thousands of people have been killed across three regions, and hundreds of thousands displaced. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi recently traveled to one area where people are still trying to recover.
The scars of war are still visible all around the Amhara region of northern Ethiopia. On the sides of the road, I see overturned military vehicles and tanks, army trenches dug into fields, buildings destroyed by months of fighting. Many places here still don't have electricity, running water, and adequate food. At a crowded warehouse in the town of Meket, hundreds of people rush to collect food aid. People carry away large sacks of wheat and other grains. On the outside, they read USAID from the American people. 18-year-old Tesfa Kasau is still waiting for her turn. She tells me it's been some 7 hours. Because of the war, the harvest was small, she tells me. It's been challenging, she says, but the aid is helping. The TPLF entered the Amhara region from Tigray back in the summer of 2021. The fighting with the Ethiopian government forces disrupted the local growing season, leaving much of the population without enough food. The manager who runs this aid warehouse gives his name as Mulat. He says the center is supplying more than 48,000 people with food, but that's a fraction of the need. NGOs say millions of people in Amhara are in need of food aid, not to mention in Tigray and a neighboring Afar region where the fighting continues. Mulat says if this area stays quiet, people can recover ahead of the upcoming harvest season. But recovering from the horrors of war will take much longer. In a nearby town, I meet Munir Desalin, a 22-year-old student. He wears a cross around his neck. Desalin tells me classes at his school recently resumed, but he's having a tough time. He tells me he can't concentrate. His mind hasn't recovered from the conflict. He leads me down a winding valley full of small farms. The TPLF controlled this area at one point, he tells me. The fighting was intense here. Desalin tells me his sister, her husband, and their 4-year-old child were killed by, they think, a mortar that hit the home in the middle of the night. Even now, there's no roof on the building. Everyone in the house died, Desalin says, except for his young nephew. 13-year-old Mulu Kantalo is lying in a small storage room beside the family's cow. Kantalo tells me he was sleeping at night when the attack happened. When he woke up, there was fire all around and people making noise. He's still recovering from his injuries. A thin blanket covers his legs and he still can't walk, which means he also can't go to school. Munir Desalin, the boy's uncle, says his nephew needs medical treatment, but that's something they can't afford. Desalin walks me to where his relatives are buried, behind a nearby church. Young religious students are here reciting verses of scripture, holding small Bibles. Their teacher, priest Case Ayala Seitain, periodically corrects them when they stumble. Seitain tells me many people here were injured during the conflict. Several houses were destroyed. Even the church sustained some damage. But he says he kept this religious school open, even when there was fighting. I tell people to go pray. Go to church. Only God can push away these evil things, he says. I pray God will bring peace and that people will be patient. Most people I meet in Amhara tell me they want this war to end. They're hoping for peace, but multiple attempts at mediation have failed. And as the conflict continues, it's fueling fear, anger, and hate. Farmer named Gashao Demize stands in front of his house. It was also partially destroyed by what he thinks was a mortar shell. The explosion, he says, killed 4 of his relatives. I'm still standing and walking, he begins, but emotionally I'm not in good shape because my daughter and many others have died. He tells me he felt safe when the federal government retook this region more than 2 months ago. But now he's been seeing military forces leave the area. That has him worried that maybe the TPLF could come back.
I want our government to stand strong against the TPLF, Dimise says, and see this fight to the end. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi, Amhara, Northern Ethiopia.
Just to the north of Ukraine is Belarus, a close ally of Russia. Belarus has become a staging ground for the Russian military's push into Ukraine. Also, it's the location of negotiations between Ukraine and Russia. Here to talk about how Belarus fits into all of this is Katya Glod. She's a fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis in Washington. Why is the Belarusian government so involved in Vladimir Putin's war, Katya?
Well, the regime of Alexander Lukashenko has been very close with the Kremlin since the fraudulent election, presidential election of August 2020, when Lukashenko is believed to have lost the election and he was not recognized as the legitimate president by the West. And the only support he received was from Vladimir Putin and from the Kremlin. Since then, the Kremlin has been very involved in the politics in Belarus, as well as in the economics, giving Belarus money to survive after the West imposed sanctions on Belarus, and also supporting Lukashenko politically. The Kremlin did not do it just for granted, and it wanted something in exchange. And the price that Belarus had to pay in return was getting closer to Russia in terms of economic integration and in terms of defense. And the latest development is a very clear example of how close Belarus came to Russia in defense and how basically the Kremlin really controls the armed forces of Belarus, and Lukashenko is not really in command any longer.
So there's a lot of disinformation out there. President Lukashenko said today that Belarus would not send troops to Ukraine. At the same time, Ukraine said today that Belarus has sent in troops. How involved in the conflict is Belarus actually?
So far, we can say for certain only that the Russian army has attacked Ukraine from Belarus. Russian convoys of weapons and troops, they moved from the side of Belarus. They occupied the area around Chernobyl, and they are currently moving closer towards Kyiv. We also know that there have been several missiles shot from the territory of Belarus. However, we don't really know if the Belarusian troops or Belarusian weapons have been involved in the war in Ukraine. Indeed, Lukashenko has said that this is not the case. I don't think we can trust his word, but also for political reasons, because war is so much unpopular in Belarus and Belarusians receive so much more alternative information than, for example, people in Russia. It would be very bad for the public, for public opinion in Belarus, for Lukashenko to get directly involved. But what is also quite likely is in case Russia would need more support, this is what Lukashenko said 2 days ago, that if there is a need for us, meaning for Belarus and for Russia, to participate in this war, we will. And I would trust his word that he would do that.
So, Katya, you mentioned the fraudulent 2020 election that brought President Lukashenko another term in office, an important moment in the recent relations between Belarus and Russia. We also saw last year the largest anti-government protests in the history of Belarus. So how is Lukashenko's future tied to the outcome of what happens in Ukraine?
Well, on the one hand, Lukashenko is now very much dependent on Putin. He depends on Putin economically and politically. Economically, because the West has imposed quite severe sanctions on Belarus following this fraudulent 2020 elections. The effect of these sanctions has been felt quite strongly in the recent months. Therefore, economically, it depends on the Kremlin giving Belarus loans. However, we have also seen that the Kremlin hasn't been so generous as it had been in the past years. For example, last week, Lukashenko asked for $3.9 billion loan from the Kremlin, and the Kremlin had agreed to give only $1 billion. And if Russia, also under the burden of the sanctions, would not be able to support Belarus financially, it's hard to imagine what Lukashenko would do, and he might as well think about changing some of his policies.
Policies like what? What can you imagine happening?
He might start talking to the Belarusian opposition. He might start releasing political prisoners. He might start, well, first of all, he might start supporting militarily Russia less, but that, of course, remains to be seen how the current conflict will play out.
Katia Glod is a fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis in Washington. Thank you very much for speaking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
In Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, Russian rockets hit a TV tower, taking some channels off the air. A miles-long convoy of Russian tanks and armored vehicles is also approaching the capital, and residents of Kyiv are taking shelter. Ukraine's foreign ministry released a video today of children in a bunker in Kyiv singing the city's anthem. Maya Mikhailuk has been sheltering in her Kyiv apartment with her family, then moving to a makeshift bomb shelter during air raids. Maya, what have the past 24 hours been like for you?
Well, it's been very tense as the bombings intensify. Kyiv is attacked mostly on the right bank and the suburbs of Kyiv. There have been battles going on in the suburbs. Russians are trying to advance with tanks. Our defenders are stopping them. But going to bed last night knowing that there are kilometers of tanks approaching Kyiv was very scary. I couldn't sleep half of the night. And we are preparing probably for even worse nights, since we just heard that the Minister of Defense of Russia openly on TV announced that they're going to bomb Kyiv today.
The bomb shelter where you are, where is it located in the city?
Well, we are on the left bank in the residential area, and we live in a multiple-storied building. We checked out the basement that was turned into a bomb shelter, and we decided not to go there. Our daughter is 39 weeks pregnant. We can't go back up and down. And we are on the seventh floor, so we decided that the safest place for us will be right here between our two apartments in the corridor. It has no windows, and it has two bearing walls from what we read. Depending what hits us, we're hoping that the walls will hold.
Right. You're making careful calculations about where to be. You have been posting about explosions that have shaken your walls and windows. That kind of experience is hard to describe for anyone who has not lived through a shelling. How are you and your family coping with all of this stress?
My family right now is me in the bomb shelter, and they are watching the news, and they're saying just now they are shelling our TV tower on the other bank. So we don't see and hear those explosions, but everybody carries the phone right now as an extension of the hand. We are just checking news obsessively to see what's happening. And of course, the signals of air raid, first we see it on the phone.
Given the suspicion that Russian forces could attack Kyiv at any moment, who is able to leave the city right now?
Anybody can try. It just, it's really not safe because suburbs of Kyiv are attacked by tanks. You never know what's going to be in the air. So we feel it's not smart to try to leave the city. But there are some trains going right now to Lviv, which is a western big city in Ukraine.
So your daughter is close to giving birth. How's she doing?
She's doing remarkably well. We are hoping that the baby will be born under peaceful, free sky of independent Ukraine. We're just asking the baby to wait a little longer.
Hmm. Does she have medical care nearby or a doctor who can assist with the delivery if
well,
it comes to
we
that?
We have a hospital 10 minutes drive from us, but 10 minutes at night in the air raid could be very long 10 minutes. So we are hoping that the baby will be coming not during the night and not during the air raid, and the hospital will be still open. But just yesterday, a maternity hospital was hit by Russian artillery in another part of Kyiv. So the hospitals in Kyiv are requesting volunteers to bring sacks of sand to barricade the windows. But we also hear that a lot of babies are born in the bomb shelters. We hope that's not going to be our situation.
Is your daughter with you now?
Yes, she is.
Resting, possibly? Is she able to find that space to relax?
It's not super comfortable. And last night when we tried to sleep in our own beds, I couldn't go to sleep. I felt like I was totally unprotected and sleeping on the streets. 2:30 in the morning, and we were forced into this corridor to be together, and it just felt safer. I slept here yesterday.
So right now, Maya, as we wait to see what the Russian military is going to do and the reaction from the city of Kyiv and the Ukrainian military, where are you looking for hope?
Well, we are looking to God for hope. We are grateful to our defenders, and we are grateful to the support of the West that finally came. We are standing against an army that is bigger, but we can't believe that God would allow aggressor to destroy Ukraine.
Maya Mikhailuk lives in Kyiv with her husband and daughter. Maya, we are thinking of you, wishing you strength and safety. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
While we stay focused on the war unfolding across Ukraine, our journalists are also focused on the rest of the globe. From desalination plants that bring water to an indigenous village in northern Mexico, to how Ghana is dealing with plastic waste in the country's waterways. Find those stories and more on theworld.org. As you've heard this hour, politicians, banks, and businesses around the globe are standing up to Russian President Vladimir Putin. International sports federations and athletes are also pushing back in big ways. The world's Bianca Hillier has that story.
On his third run at the Beijing Olympics, skeleton racer Vladislav Haraskevich flew down the ice at over 70 miles per hour. At the end of the run, the Ukrainian athlete got off his sled and walked toward the camera.
And he held up a sign saying, "No war in Ukraine."
No war in Ukraine. That was February 11th. Haraskevich says he was protesting the escalating tensions back home as Russian troops rapidly assembled at Ukraine's border.
At that moment, I hope that it can help. It can change something, small step.
But just a week after Haraskevich returned home, Russian troops began their attack. He says he spent the first few days in Kyiv helping a relative get out safely. He's now staying with family just outside the city.
It's terrible what we have now, and it's hard. Absolutely nightmare.
Just weeks ago, the 23-year-old was at the Olympics in Beijing. Now, he says his entire life has changed.
If country needs me to take weapon, I'm ready for it, and I'm ready to defend my land and my family.
He's not the only one. Ukrainian Stanislav Harona won a bronze medal in karate at last year's Tokyo Games. Today, he's joined the fight.
Друзі, привіт. Сьогодні 1 березня, і це моє день народження.
Standing with a gun and wearing protective gear, Haruna asked his followers to donate to the nation's army.
Thank you. Stand with Ukraine.
Other athletes are advocating for international sports bodies to take action against Russia. Haraskevich helped organize a letter and video addressed to the International Olympic and Paralympic Committees. In a video montage, Ukrainian athletes made their request clear.
We, Ukrainian athletes, ask.
Suspend immediately Russian and Belarusian National Olympic Committees.
Suspend Russian and Belarusian athletes and officials from the participation in Paralympic Winter Games in Beijing 2022.
Hundreds of international athletes have now co-signed the letter. Paralympic committees from the U.S., Canada, the U.K., and Germany also support the ban. The IPC has condemned Russia's invasion and says it will announce the team's fate tomorrow, just 2 days before the opening ceremony. But at other sport organizations, action has been more swift.
September's Russian Grand Prix has been cancelled.
Russia and Belarus being suspended by World Rugby until further notice.
International Ice Hockey Council also suspends Russia and Belarus national teams.
Similar moves have also come from skiing, curling, and track and field federations. And in the soccer world, just yesterday, FIFA and UEFA suspended Russia from all competitions, including qualifying games for the 2022 Men's World Cup. Athletes are also showing solidarity with Ukraine, like Russian tennis pro Andrei Rublev.
They might just have a message that we can get behind that.
On Friday, Rublev wrote, "No war, please," on a camera lens. After winning the match, he put tennis into perspective.
In these moments, you realize that my match is not important because what's happening is much more terrible
And you realize how important it is to have peace in the world and to be united.
And over the weekend in the UK,
Manchester City all showing their support, wearing Ukrainian colours on their chest. The Everton players draped in the Ukraine flag.
The entire stadium roared in support of the Ukrainian players on both teams. It brought Man City's Oleksandr Zinchenko to tears and prompted him to organize within his sport. Today, Zinchenko released a video with more than a dozen other Ukrainian footballers. They're asking global fans to resist the war, oppose Russian propaganda, and send resources to Ukraine. Back near Kyiv, skeleton racer Vladislav Hereskevich is pleading for the same. And when Ukraine's Paralympic team competes at next week's Beijing Games, he says their message will be strong.
We want to show we are peaceful people, we are united people, and Ukraine is a good country.
For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Ukraine's response to the Russian invasion has a David and Goliath quality to it. This week, Ukraine's Ministry of Defense posted how-to instructions online for disabling a Russian tank. One illustration shows how to tangle up a tank's tracks with a section of pipe. Or, if you've got wine or beer bottles handy, the ministry says you can try this. They explain what ingredients to put in the bottle, how to make the fuse, and you've got a Molotov cocktail. In this video from Radio Free Europe, Ukrainians show how to make improvised napalm. It's self-evident, but I'll say it anyway. Do not try this at home. It is very dangerous and totally illegal. But in Ukraine right now, it's government policy. This video was filmed inside a car driving past a Russian tank. A passenger hurls a lit petrol bomb and hits her target. This is not the first time a government has told its citizens how to bomb an enemy vehicle. This British newsreel from 1940 shows how to attack a German tank with a barrage of petrol bombs.
A barricade buzzed away to a phony Nazi tank, all dolled up for the benefit of home guardsmen, armed with highly volatile Molotov cocktails.
Do-it-yourself bottle bombs got their name just 1 year earlier in Finland. Resistance fighters there threw them at the invading Soviet army and named their bottle bombs after the Soviet foreign minister at the time, Vyacheslav Molotov. Now it's Ukraine that's using the petrol bombs, and not for the first time there either.
Actually, we built on our knowledge of chemistry and our experience from 2014 Maidan Revolution to make good quality Molotov cocktails.
Yuri Zastavny runs the Pravda Brewery in Lviv near Ukraine's western border with Poland. He told Sky News yesterday that he stopped bottling beer. Now his brewery is turning the bottles into Molotov cocktails.
There is a high time in everyone's life when you really have to mobilize yourself, to use all your knowledge, all your energy to making the fall of this empire possible, making the future of your kids better.
Fighting for the freedom of Ukraine, one bottle at a time. That is our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We'll be back with you tomorrow with more coverage from Ukraine and other stories from across the world. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. From PRX.